Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Deidre Tyler, host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Lisa Briggs, the author of The Healing Stage, Black Women, Incarceration, and the Art of Transformation. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you so much, Dr. Taylor, for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm really just so honored to be with you.
Thank you. I wonder if you could start by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in this project.
Absolutely. So I'm a little Black girl from the South Side of Chicago, born and raised, and grew up in the 80s and the 90s, right in this, as the war on drugs was really impacting cities across the nations, and especially people in the city of Chicago. I was a really shy child, and theater really saved my life. And many years later, after I, worked as an actor and a playwright, I had a chance to work with a group of women who were in a comprehensive drug and alcohol program at a program called the Living Stage Theater, which was in Washington, D.C. Part of my adult, acting career, I moved around a lot and worked in regional theaters quite a bit, and so when the opportunity to settle down and work in Washington, D.C. at the Living Stage happened, I took advantage of it. I leapt to it. At Living Stage did improvisational theater for social change with community groups. And we talked about the real things that people were dealing with, were struggling with. And this one group of women, I'll never forget them. They were in a comprehensive drug and alcohol recovery program, and mostly Black women. A couple women who were there with their mothers. We would sit in circle, and they could tell stories about anything that was on their mind. Often they talked about their recovery journeys and what it meant to heal. And at the time I was a 27, 28-year-old young woman, really trying to figure out my place in the world and understand these experiences that I had had, and felt very much like alone in them. Like I said, I'm like many people, I grew up during the war on drugs. And while it didn't immediately impact my family with, I don't have a parent who was lost to the carceral system or had a chronic substance abuse problem, I do have family members like that. And there was very little honest conversation about accountability, about safety and justice and security at the time. But these women, we're having those conversations, and with them, I guess we all together realized that we had a lot in common. We might be sitting on opposite sides of the circle. We may have gotten to living stage in different ways, but we shared a lot in common. And one of the things that really propelled my interest in the role of the arts in terms of a healing practice is an exchange I had with a woman named Rosetta. We were all told to write some poems in response to a prompt that the facilitator that day, Rebecca Rice, gave. And I was an assistant, so my job was to pass out like paper and pens. And so I passed, and I did this every day to for people, but I passed out the paper and pen. I went to Rosetta, I gave them to her, and she looked me in the eye, grabbed my hand and said, "I cannot write a poem. I cannot write a poem." And I said to her, I didn't even blink. I said, "Yes, you can. You can write a poem. Yes, you can." And then I moved on to the next person and kept doing my, you know, my job. Well, I didn't know that Rosetta had never written a poem, but that that day she would pick up the pen and piece of paper and she would write her first poem, and that she would read it in class, and it would be the first time that she'd ever read a poem she'd written aloud. And that that moment would propel her to become not only our resident poet, but really a spokesperson for her group, and later on a published poet. And many, many years later, when I decided to go back to graduate school, I have a PhD in performance studies from Northwestern, I wanted to reconnect with her group. And she told me, I sat down with her, she'd stabilized in recovery with three other women. And she told me that that day that I opened up something in her, I affirmed which I guess she called the still small voice within her, that wanted to write poems and had a lot to say, but had never been validated. And so, or affirmed in a way that it needed to be affirmed or was affirmed that day. And so that's how I came to this work. I've been interested for a long time in theater in non-traditional spaces, theater that's not about commercial success, but theater that really is a space in which people come together to tell the most powerful stories about their lives, to make them discussable, to make them available for other people so that we might collectively think about our human worth and value. And then how people out of those experiences, you know, transform their individual lives and then have, in some cases, impact their communities. So that's a very long explanation, but that's how I got to this work. So.
Thank you. Well, in the introduction, you gave the reader a lot of statistics about the increasing number of women and specifically Black women behind bars. Tell us more about that.
It's one of the hidden effects of the war on drugs. Actually, it precedes the war on drugs. People usually credit Ronald Reagan with declaring the war on drugs, but really the story of mass incarceration reaches way, 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 way back to the early days of the American experiment. Most recently, though, since the 1970s, Black women have been amongst the fastest growing segment of the prison population. That's because of the declaration of the war on drugs, which transformed how policing operates. So we've moved from a model that, of course, always targeted the poor, always targeted people with mental health diseases and disorders, always targeted men of color. But with the early 1970s, in response to Black liberation organizing, folks like President Nixon and his colleagues, both sides of the aisle, legislators and communities, decided that we would re-up the use of the prison system and jails and police in order to clamp down on Black organizing, and women became a new target. Part of that is because of changes in what they call gender-neutral policing. So if a domestic violence call happens, the cops show up at the door. In the past, they would ignore, they would ignore the call, but under gender-neutral policing, instead of trying to figure out who did what, they just arrest everybody. And then they walk around the house, and if there's kids there or if it's a low-income family and they don't think that the children are well cared for based on the condition of, say, a refrigerator, then usually women, overwhelmingly women, wind up facing additional charges that have nothing to do with the initial call. So as a result, Black women have been overwhelmingly impacted by this change in policy. There's been an over 700% increase in their numbers between 1970 and 2020 alone. So at this point, Black women are overrepresented in the criminal legal system, but largely ignored. They're assumed to be, when they are arrested, to be criminals. And if they do not adhere to dominant norms and expectations about appropriate female behavior or mothering practices, then they serve more time than any other woman.
Tell us about the prisons and jails you visited and your field work.
Thank you for that. Yes, I spent on and off about 10, 12 years working in prisons and jails, three in the United States and one in Johannesburg, South Africa. In the book, The Healing Stage, I don't share their real names. I use pseudonyms in order to protect the identities of the people who were involved in the prison art programs that I studied. But I can say that I worked in two jails, one in the Midwest, and then one in the Mid-Atlantic region, and then a women's maximum security prison in the Gulf Coast. And then in South Africa, I actually followed a woman named Rodessa Jones, and that is her real name. I can share her real name. She's a San Francisco-based theater artist and theater for social change, theater for incarcerated women instructor. And she got a fabulous opportunity to go to South Africa, to Johannesburg, with the invitation of a group called Urban Voices and Roshni Mustami to work with women at the what they call it, the lovingly or somewhat lovingly, jokingly, Sun City, which is a maximum security, minimum, medium, and maximum security complex outside of Soweto. And there's one women's facility there. And so I went with her between 2009 and 2012 to do intensive workshops and help them remount, restage, expand, and perform their work on the national stage at the State Theater in Pretoria. So and then subsequently after that, I've had a chance to work with some of the women who've been released from these programs. So that's how I those are the sites. I do ethnography, so I spend a lot of time with people. We joke then some in anthropology or performance studies that the kind of ethnographic field work we do looks like hanging out, but it's really critical hanging out. I think of myself as a critical performance ethnographer, meaning that I'm interested in partnering with people to tell their stories, but also to uplift their voices and the issues that are most pressing to them. So I don't pretend to be a fly on the wall. I don't pretend that I'm able to understand their lives and experiences through observation. I spend time in each one of my sites, you know, participating in workshop. So if they were doing prompts about to write something, I wrote things. If they were doing exercises, if they were singing and dancing, I was singing and dancing as much as I was allowed to do in each site and as felt appropriate. As sites move toward production, so in each one, in a small ensemble of women, they develop, write, produce, and perform a play of their own making to an audience of other women at their facility. And as shows moved from the rehearsal or the devising period, into production, my role would change. So I became more of an assistant director or sometimes more like a just backstage help. So helping people get in and out of costume or move props or deal with emergencies that always happen behind stage, backstage. So
can you tell the audience, what does healing for women in jail and prisons look like? Give us an example.
You know, this was a really central question of the book. I was curious, based on my own experience as a theater artist, and then, like I said, at Living Stage, and about this idea of theater being a healing practice in a carceral space, in a prison or a jail. When I started, my assessment of why, my understanding of why women were behind bars was it was different than where I am now. Certainly the factors that I talked about before in terms of the war on drugs put them there. This effort to end Black liberation organizing, a real hatred about the poor, a desire to regulate them, and chronic substance use issues as a pretext or a guide for locking people up. And in my original thinking, you know, like, how does a theater program behind bars end poverty? Those were the kind of the questions that I was asking. So when I sat with people in workshop, I was trying to understand what did they mean when they said the work was healing. And what I came to understand over time was that Of course, everybody knows that theater is not going to end poverty. Theater is not going to end homelessness. But healing isn't just about coming up with a snap cure. There's a difference between a healing process and curing something. Healing is a process of self-repair, and it's one that requires collaborative work with other people. And in theater programs for incarcerated women, the first thing that people wanted to do is to be seen and heard and understood exactly as they were. So to not have to hide, to not feel ashamed or angry. They needed the theater programs became a place where they could, in their loneliness and isolation. And so one example of that happened in this jail in the Midwest. Every day, me and the facilitator, who in the book I call Aaron, we would go and they would facilitate a small group conversation. You'd start off with some jokes and then we would get to writing, and he would always bring a writing prompt. And it didn't matter what the prompt was. Every day, once a week, every day, at least one person would reveal the story of surviving domestic violence or sexual assault. It didn't matter if the prompt was about flowers, or if it was about the idea of a home, or you know, what you had for breakfast, or what you'd like to have for breakfast. Somewhere in there, the story that people wanted to tell and wanted to have witnessed by us was about surviving domestic violence and sexual assault. And Aaron created a space in which they could tell those stories. And the fact that he did it in a way so masterfully that they felt that they could tell those stories and be seen, heard, and recognized, but then also that the burden of carrying that shame, that anger, that loneliness was shared amongst us. We didn't, you know, poo-poo them. We didn't look down upon them. What they learned in the process of telling and listening to each other and listening to how Aaron facilitated those conversations with them was that they were not alone, that many of us in the room had endured similar violence in our homes, at our workplaces, on the streets. And so in like I said, healing is a process of self-repair, but it requires the support of other people. In order for healing to happen, you have to have support of other people. And so those workshop spaces became ones in which such support was offered. And from there, people could begin to do other individual work if they so desired, if they wanted to. So that's one example of how a theater program can offer people healing on the individual level, and then create a collective space for people to do additional work if they so desire. So,
you talk about rehabilitation. Tell us about some of the things that the women had to learn, patterns and practices after being released.
Okay, yeah. So, thank you for that question. Yeah, in the book, I really try and following the interlocutors, the women at these sites, I really draw a distinction between the idea of healing as a process of self-repair and rehabilitation as defined by the state, by the prisons and jails, by officers, and unfortunately by like dominant society. What the women taught me is that rehab in their facilities is basically like a three-part kind of ritual in which you're expected to confess to whatever you've been accused of, express remorse, and then comply with officers' orders, whatever those may be. Behind bars, people consider a compliant prisoner to be a rehabilitated one. And because women's facilities are terribly underfunded in terms of programming, the theater programs that I worked with, they were all run by volunteers. They got some grant money occasionally, but really it was people did it out of a love and a desire to support folks behind bars to reach and work with other women. Because women's facilities, women behind bars are about 10% of the population across the country. So if there's like 2.1 million, 2.2 million people behind bars any given day now, there's about 200,000, 225,000 women. And because they're such a small number, there is not adequate or ever really consistent vocational, educational, recreational, religious programming. So if you're going to change because you don't want to go back to jail or the circumstances that you were in are intolerable to you now, you really have to figure out other ways of getting support to make that happen. And sure, there's like an army of social services that are available, but that it doesn't mean that just because the services aren't there doesn't mean that they're actually helping people where they're at. People need a lot more help than what they're getting, a lot more help than what they're getting, a lot more help than what they're getting. And what women who have been behind bars realize is that they have to help each other and themselves, and that there are some allies, of course, out there. But that for those who went through the theater programs and stuck with it, that the theater program, even though, you know, it doesn't perhaps, you know, to some make any logical sense that that be the site where you get support, the theater programs told them that as they moved through their sentences, if they were long or short, that they were there on the outside for them. And so at each site, and the Medea Project is a really great example of this, based in San Francisco, because they've been around for 30 plus years, that once you get out of a correctional facility and, you know, you need a place to stay, you need a new network, you need work, you need just, you know, people around you who understand where you've been and what you need, that you can reach out to them. And so the Medea Project, for one, is a site in which women have, formerly incarcerated women have formed an ensemble, and the Medea Project creates new work all the time about their life on both sides of the prison door. At other sites in the Mid-Atlantic, folks have actually the experience of taking workshop with arts programs like the Living Stage propelled them to, you know, once they stabilized in recovery and got their kids back, got housing, they've become advocates for women who are behind bars. They do workshops very similar to the ones that I described at the beginning, in order to communicate vital information about what you need in order to really get help, because they know, they've been through all the programs. They've, you know, it's kind of like they've done every Weight Watchers diet plan you can think of and imagine. And they know what people really need. And unfortunately, the criminal legal system doesn't support their work financially so that they can make a significant and sustained impact. But through the arts programs, they're able to, I like to say, smuggle in vital information. And then they are people who will meet you at the door as soon as you get released 12:01 a.m. so that you don't have to go back to your abusive home. You don't have to go back to your pimp if that's the configuration you're living in. You don't have to go back to your dealer. You can get a bite to eat. You can get some clothes. So that's something that I learned through this research, that the theater programs are just kind of the first introduction to a whole other way of being in the world for women who are willing to and excited by entering the work, becoming the storytellers that they naturally are, and learning day by day, inch by inch, how to live in a new way. And then from there to make a new world so that people who are struggling in deep poverty don't have to be struggling anymore. So we can, you know, work together to address people's actual needs.
I'm going to now go through some of the chapters and ask you about some stories that I found to be so interesting. In chapter one, you entitled it, "She Was No Rosa Parks." Tell us about the story of Joanne Little.
Thank you so much for that question, Joanne Little. So Joanne Little, I start with her story as a way of like a preface to this, a big history of the incarceration of Black women. And I named the chapter, she was no Rosa Parks, because people in her neighborhood, in her community in North Carolina in the early 1970s called Joanne Little that. Joanne Little was a young woman in her early 20s who she was struggling when she was arrested in the early 1970s on charges of breaking into other Black people's trailers in her community. And she had grown up in a blended family. She was, had been a runaway. She'd had some problems as a teenager. And as a young woman in her early 20s, late teens, early 20s, she had gotten involved allegedly with a guy, much older guy, who ran a local bar. He also might have been the head of a burglary ring and a prostitution organization also. But she got caught and held in the local jail. And while she was there, she was held in the men's section. And white officers, there were only white officers at this facility, began to sexually harass her. They peeked in on her as she changed her clothes. They would catcall and try and grope her. She was not the first or only woman that this had happened to, but one night, she was the only woman in the jail, and an officer decided that he was going to offer her a plate of food, a sandwich. And he came into her cell with his a crowbar, and he offered her a plate. But he also insisted that she perform oral sex on him. And to stop the rape, she got the crowbar and she hit him multiple times, and then she ran away. She escaped using his keys, and she was on the lam for about 2 weeks, and she turned herself in. She told, with the support of her lawyers, the authorities, and everyone who would listen, that she had been sexually assaulted, that she had been raped, and that she had only killed this man in order to save her life. Unfortunately, because of her history of truancy and people's, you know, assessment of her character, even people in her town said she was no Rosa Parks. So, meaning that she was not a respectable woman, and therefore she was not to be believed, that she had been assaulted, that that she perhaps deserved it, that she perhaps had seduced this man and was now lying to get out of a murder charge, which at the time could have meant the death penalty for her. So in this chapter, I trace a history of how women just like Joanne Little have been treated by the criminal legal system. And using archival materials, I learned that the low-income women like Joanne, people with limited family support and community engagement, people who have been accused of or engaged in sex work and crimes of poverty, like breaking into to trailers or shoplifting, that they are the women who we see behind bars. More than 80% of, 90% rather, of women who are behind bars are survivors of domestic violence and sexual assaults, many of which occurred before they were 13 years old. And these are, you know, crimes that no one is in jail for, no one has been held accountable for, and for which they were not believed, understood, or respected. There's been no accountability for them. So even though people in the time that Joanne Little case was in the national spotlight, you know, dismissed her for her so-called disrespectful character and behavior, she was actually absolutely emblematic of women who were behind bars then and who we continue to meet now. Her legal defense team was masterful, though, in complicating the narrative that blamed her for the violence that she had experienced, and ultimately was successful in winning her release on these charges. She was found not guilty. A huge coalition of prison rights, prisoner rights, women's rights, Black liberation activists and organizers came together. Even Sweet Honey in the Rock wrote a song about her, the chorus of which goes, Joanne Little, that's my sister, Joanne Little, and on and on and on. You know, her case is important in history, not only because of it got her free and this coalition became together, but because it set up a precedent that a little Black woman, that a Black woman, a woman behind bars, has the right to use deadly, lethal force in order to protect her life, even against a person in uniform. That is something that had never been established in U.S. Jurisprudence up until that point. And while I can't say that her case transformed the conditions of women's confinement behind bars, it certainly put a spotlight on it and helped people understand, some people understand, who really is behind bars. We have overwhelmingly criminalized low-income women, women of color, who are survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault for what they do to survive that violence. So that's the story of Joanne Little.
Thank you. In your chapter one, you gave us a history of race, gender, and inferiority. Can you give us some summary of that, what you were trying to say?
Yes, absolutely. I think what I'm trying to say in that opening chapter is to really lay this context out that we have an immediate experience with the war on drugs and the rise of mass incarceration. But in that chapter, I unpack the idea that prisons and jails are a new way of regulating women of color, Black women in particular. And let me back up. What's a better way of saying this? That in that chapter, I use archival materials in order to really demonstrate how the United States has always imagined the prison system as a way of enforcing and creating an inferior class, a criminalized class. So colonial laws, you know, as after the revolution, get adapted into U.S. laws. And they do that because the social contract is always written, the Constitution being, you know, the most obvious or legible outgrowth of this idea of the social contract, that people come together to regulate and to manage each other under a political system, versus a monarchy in which it's, you know, the king or the monarch is divinely anointed. And so there's no way of changing that system. But under a democracy formed through a social contract, there's this understanding that citizens decide that they are going to live under some kind of form of government and that they have the right to transform it. Unfortunately, in the United States, our Constitution is written by slaveholders and landowners who are just a very, very small percentage of the total population. And they create the Constitution and the laws that that flow from it in order to always cohere and to support and perpetuate their model of democracy, in which they are the people who are allowed to and empowered to dictate everyday life. Of course, people from other walks of life, socioeconomic backgrounds, always push back. So it's never like a one-shot, you know, it's one shot and done kind of situation. Culture, society is a site of contestation over who's valued and what they're valued for. But the American system very much pulls upon colonial models, colonial practices, and it uses the criminal legal system from the beginning in order to regulate low-income people, people of color, Black and Indigenous people in particular, and later the growing number of Asian folks who arrive. And to create this tiered system. So we have a tiered social order. So we have a tiered system of justice, actually, that dates back to the colonial era. So we've always over-policed and under-protected women and women and Black and Brown people. So that shows up in, you know, a unique set of codes that were built into the American early American criminal legal system. The slave codes that have been in place, you know, we modify them only slightly, but those slave codes that are in place through the end of the Civil War, they set a whole set of punishments that are only available to Black people and a set of crimes that are only available to them as well. So those are things from, you know, talking back to white people, to not getting off the street, to, you know, eating food, so-called stealing from their kitchens, things that people would do every day to survive.
Now, I'm going to move towards when Black young women started moving into cities. What were some of the risks that was involved in terms of they being criminalized?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah. So, you know, there were people always assumed that Black women after the Civil War, as they move, you know, fleeing the South, looking for new opportunities, that they're there for kind of nefarious purposes. The idea of an unregulated Black woman would just, it was intolerable. And so Black women and girls could be harassed for just, you know, walking around, for being out, quote unquote, after hours, for wearing clothing that white people thought was above their station. For, I mean, certainly there were some people, right, who for whom the underground economy, so like gambling and sex work or dancing or whatever, is the only way that they can make a living wage. But everyday Black women are also a subject to these punitive laws, just outrageous laws, fighting back, living in a cohabitating with someone of the same gender, being in a same-sex relationship. All of these things brought the ire of the growing policing force. So those are some of the things that women were subjected to. Yeah, and as they move out of the South and into growing cities and urban areas.
Now, you talk about Cynthia Scott and the police. Tell us briefly her story.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, Cynthia Scott is a great example of this, of the way that policing has grown up to be targeted to stop women's movement. So, Cynthia Scott was a very tall Black woman, and basically on early morning Independence Weekend, 1963, she's in Detroit, and she's out with a man, like 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and she gets flagged down by Detroit police. They pull her over and accuse her of solicitation of sex work. She denies it. The man that she's with, first name Charles, also says, no, like that's not what's going on. That's not what's going on at all. The cops do not believe either one of them. They go through Cynthia's handbag. She has some money, $43. And based on that and her presence out at night after hours, they decide that she's engaged in sex work. And so she, they try and arrest her, put her in the car. She slips them and runs, and they shoot her three times, twice in the back, once in the stomach. She falls face down in the middle of the street. And I know that this is a difficult story to hear, but she dies on site in a way that's very similar to the police murders that we've seen over the last 5-10 years that have been videotaped. Her case is different though, in that a huge community of people in Detroit got activated around her case and said that they were not going to let the police get away with this murder, that the police don't have the right to murder you, to kill you as you're running away. And they certainly don't have the right to kill you based on accusations of their suspicions that you're engaged in a particular kind of so-called illegal behavior. I mean, she was murdered in the street. And we don't often hear these stories about police violence against women, but But hers is exactly that is exactly is an example of exactly what actually happens every day. Women get targeted by police, and they get they do get murdered. They do get accused wrongfully in many cases. And later on, people would learn that, you know, the police are actually and often use their power and authority in the city of Detroit, as they do all over the place, to solicit sexual favors from women, so that they, you know, with a promise like, "Oh, I won't arrest you if you do this, that, and the other for me," and that they regularly, on duty, sexually assault and rape women. So her story is one example of, you know, how violence against women, against young Black women, is not only happens every day, but it is state sanctioned. It's become an everyday part of policing. And it's one of the things that the women that I met were actively trying to stop in their various ways, first by healing themselves, and then later on, where possible, by really engaging in activism to transform what we think of justice, how safety is understood, and then to really rethink, reimagine, and in some cases abolish policing as we know it.
In chapter two, you talk about how to stage healing. I thought it was so interesting you found the Parchment Women's songs. What were some of the information that you gained from listening or looking at the lyrics?
Yeah, the Parchment Farm, those women in Parchment Farm, Mississippi. Yeah, those women. So they recorded the blues in a sewing room, and listening to their songs, in particular one by a woman named Maddie May. She sang so beautifully about just what we've been talking about, how her life was haunted by violence. That she sings about a woman who hits the road. She's fleeing a house that's dangerous, that's not supported. This is not part of the story about women's migration to urban areas that we often hear about, dating back to the early 1910s, 20s, 30s. But she's a woman who was fleeing violence. She was a woman who was seeking a new way of defining herself. She got picked up basically for standing around, much in the way that Cynthia Scott did, for just being out in public. And then locked behind bars at Parchment Farm, which is it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a penal farm where women work day and night, doing laundry, cooking, cleaning, doing farm work. But also her song reveals that she and other women were expected to do sexual favors, to do sex work behind bars. That was part of their punishment. And the end of the song, it concludes with these lyrics about how she had a baby, and it had blue eyes. She had blue eyes, and she sees the captain, by which she means the captain of the correctional officers, like the team that's working there, hanging around. So there's a sense of haunting in the song. And what I learned from it is this vital information about how women get targeted by the criminal legal system, how it seeks to regulate their behavior, and then what punishment means for them. There's also a sense, though, in that song, and Angela Davis talks about this in her evaluation or assessment of this song, that within that song, there is a hint of a threat that you can keep hanging around, but I'm gonna do something about it. And that is a really important part of the experiences of women behind bars, that they move from a feeling that there's nothing that they can do about their circumstances, but a desire to make change, to understanding that there are options for them. They can change. They may not change in ways that the police system, the courts value and recognize as being important or worthy, but this cannot persist. They do not want, part of their healing process is understanding they're not going to pass this stuff on to other people. They're not going to allow this violence to continue. They're not going to harm themselves. They're not going to harm other people. And they're going to do what they can to stop to stop the harm that they have endured from occurring for other people.
In the chapter labeled Bad, 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 Bad Women, Midwestern, what was the central thing that you gained from going there and meeting the people?
That was the first place that I went to. That's where I spent 18 months with them every week, every Friday morning with Aaron, the young man who I spoke about earlier. I think one of the big takeaways was definitely that healing for them, that healing is not a finding a cure. It's a series of steps, and that the first one, one of the first ones, is recognizing the sense of isolation, the fear, the loneliness, that in order for people to heal, that healing is ending that loneliness. Healing is not a one-shot kind of story or narrative or cure, but a whole process of self-repair. And so really the idea of healing being a process of repair, something that people will need to do for themselves and together. I think that's one of the biggest things that I took away, and that ending loneliness and isolation is healing.
The chapter entitled The Pink Dress, Big Water Maximum Security Prison for Women on the Gulf Coast. What was the warden's expectation for the women?
Oh, that one. Gosh. Big Water, man. Oh, so that one's in, as you might imagine from the name, it's in the Gulf Coast. And so Southern state, but not alone in this expectation articulated by the warden that women who are behind bars act like, quote unquote, nice ladies. So that they, he meant by that they were upstanding, respectable Christian ladies who didn't married nice men and had loving children and were flawless in their self-presentation. When he got hired, should have known, but when we're talking about incarcerating women, we're talking about incarcerating every kind of woman. So there was a significant number, as there are in most facilities, of women who are transgender, people who are engaged in same-sex relationships, people who are lesbians. And he, though, wanted women to act in ways that were just ridiculous. His expectations about what a proper lady was just so grounded in kind of a myth about a good upstanding woman that I think very few of any women have ever been able to actually achieve. And if they have, in many places at great cost to themselves. So what he encountered was a group of butch lesbians who were he thought causing all kinds of disruption behind bars. And sometimes people do that, right? There are some dangerous people behind bars. But as in everywhere, people get into conflicts with people who they know and can't resolve conflicts in other ways. So there was no more, messing around going on there than any other place. But corrections lore says that women who engage in same-sex relationships are the causes of all problems. And this is something that goes back, hundreds of years, that it's the so-called prison lesbian, the aggressive prison lesbian who disrupts operations, who seduces innocent white women into lives of crime. And so he found a group of women there who were wearing their clothes in a too masculine fashion and engaged in same-sex relationships. And so he stripped them, this group of Black women, and forced them to wear what he called the pink dress, which was like a pink muumuu kind of thing. It was a bed sheet, basically, with a hole for the head cut out. But when women who were forced to wear that dress showed up at drama club, first, admittedly, everybody like fell out laughing because it was so ridiculous. But then they had a really poignant series of conversations about what this punishment was doing to them. So it, it was destroying people's sense of their safety, their self-esteem. It was separating them from really vital networks that they needed behind bars. And I don't just mean like, you know, relationships, but in order, like sexual relationships, but in order to survive, people have to form communities everywhere. That's part of human nature. And behind bars, people rely upon each other to figure out how day-to-day life happens, and then to get things that you need. So in exchange, I'll do, you know, I'll give you a pack of ramen noodles in exchange for like a cigarette or whatever it is. You know, these are systems of exchange. People do this everywhere. And being in the pink dress, which was such a prominent signal that you were violating prison norms, meant that some of those networks got interrupted. And so the pink dress group decided that they were not having it. And so they figured out a very subtle way of incorporating their stories, their experiences about the pink dress into a performance piece that ultimately wound up transforming how that punishment process, it contributed to it. I think he actually probably figured out that you can't use uniforms to punish people in that way that he set out. But yeah, the pink dress is a story about those gender norms and expectations, and their efforts to push back upon the limiting narrative and dialed story about them, to say that, you know, what it means to be a woman is much, where people are women, they're not dresses.
Now, you traveled to South Africa. What did you find once you got there and once you studied that program?
Right. So the women's, Sun City, they call the prison in Johannesburg. It, you know, the women there were very similar to the women that I had seen in other sites in the U.S. Overwhelmingly Black women, beautiful, there for crimes of poverty. But unlike in the U.S., where people are primarily there for like sex work, shoplifting, problematic substance use, the people in South Africa, they were there for shoplifting, but they were also there for like armed robbery. They were there for carjacking in larger numbers than in the U.S. sites. And they were overwhelmingly not drug users. They were the mules. They were women who had been recruited by an international drug organization to travel to Brazil, Afghanistan, Poland, wherever drugs were being manufactured. And they carried those drugs back to South Africa for subsequent sale and distribution. So it was a very kind of different profile. But like in the U.S., there is no services, no support, no networks. They really wore threadbare clothing in a way that was shocking and deeply disturbing. I will say, though, that in South Africa, they had, in many ways, a much more hopeful sense of what was possible for women behind bars. When you finished your sentence, you were done with your sentence. You didn't have to go on like external monitoring with an ankle bracelet. There wasn't parole, probation. Mm-mm. You did your days and then you were out. There was also a sense that, you know, it was much clearer, I think, that the historic and ongoing legacy of the apartheid regime, so the system of racial oppression put into place by white supremacist colonists in the early 20th century, and then overthrown by Black activists in the early 1990s, and then truly transformed with the institution of a new constitution and the election of Nelson Mandela in the early 1990s, that they understood that legacy of over 200 years of varying levels of colonial white supremacist oppression had impoverished people deeply. And so when they locked people up, I mean, there was also a sense that people understood this is poverty. This is racism at work. There was still a lot of the Christian kind of evangelical message about penance and, you know, confessing and expressing remorse. And if you just comply with officers' orders, you'll be, you know, rehabilitated. But there was also this counter dialogue going on there, really in earnest, that the women were involved in, about, you know, what do we really need to change? And that this, what's offered to us, is not sufficient. This is not changing our lives. We're putting our money and our resources in absolutely the wrong place. And so when they created shows, they told their show, Serious Fun at Sun City, tells a story about, yeah, transatlantic drug trafficking, as well as domestic violence, sexual assault, but then also about white supremacy and how white colonists immiserated Black communities and continued to steal from them.
You talk about your experience with Lolo and what you gained from that interaction. Tell us about that.
The chapter, It's Been My Healing to Tell the Dirty Truth. Yeah, Lolo was a woman who actually, I met her many, many years ago in the same program where I met Rosetta. And Lolo was my guide in so many ways. To not only understand how, like, the impact of a theater programmer, or she often did poetry programs at the jail where she worked, but how formerly incarcerated women, people who had stabilized in recovery from chronic problematic substance use issues, how they could take the lessons that they had learned on both sides of the prison door and advocate for themselves and for others. So Lolo's story is really a remarkable one. I mean, she and this cohort of four other women, they kept themselves clean and sober. They got a lot of great therapy. They got individual family and family therapy, but they also, the four of them, made a commitment that they were not going to go back to the lives that they had led, that every day they were going to fight to figure out how to be healthier. And part of the ways that they did that was by making commitments to help other women. And so they went to Lolo, and I followed her. I went with her to the local jail to teach workshops that smuggled in vital information about how one, what people really need in order to stabilize in recovery and to heal. But she also took that message to Capitol Hill. She took it to legislators, the Congressional Black Caucus. She and her group, their pseudonym is the Healing Justice Mamas. They created what are often unusual partnerships with organizations that I didn't think and that made a lot of sense with initially. But she really taught me that that healing is a process that doesn't stop. It's every day. And it requires not only individual transformation, but this community support, in that if we're going to get people the resources that they need, then that means getting the people in public office. It means telling those stories again and again and again, including the people who you don't think you're going to be an ally, because you don't actually know. You don't actually know who is listening and for whom this story resonates. I mean, we right now, yeah, think about Hunter Biden and the Biden family and how hard it must be every day for he, as a person who's struggling in recovery, to also be in the public eye in this way. I mean, like a lot of people, all of us, we make mistakes, we do things that are wrong, we harm other people, but a part of the healing process is learning how to be accountable to self and to others, to learn to really like and love yourself more than what any other person thinks, and to accept your whole self, your whole being. Lolo and her group that I call the Healing Justice Mamas, they are, they are warriors in that they are fearless, and their courage to show up in these spaces where they definitely could have been ridiculed, dismissed, disgraced, triggered, and it inspired me in so many ways, and it continues to inspire me every day.
The last chapter, Beyond Incarceration, what did you learn from the Big Water Theater Program Summit?
That's a thank you for that question, because that last chapter, yeah, it's a I had a chance to go to a ritual, a ceremony, a gathering, a summit that the Big Water Theater Company staged with some formerly incarcerated women, and then with some of the leading political activists on this issue from around the country. What they were working on that was part of the summit, though, was to free one of their longest, most dedicated members, a woman who I call Ava in the book. Ava had served 5 decades behind bars. She had been there longer than the men with whom she was convicted of. It was a robbery that in which somebody got killed. And Ava was an elder. She was a woman who the state was basically punishing for not only the crime that she committed, but because she'd embarrassed them a few times by she escaped at some point, and then they recaptured her, and she served many more years for the escape than for the crime for which she was initially convicted. But at this summit, the group unveiled a handmade quilt that had the names of all of the women serving life sentences. And at the time, Ava was one of them. And as it gets unveiled, though, one of the facilitators of the drama club at Big Water, a woman who I call Jody, comes up to me and she says, you know, Ava's coming home. And I have this moment of like, I'm overwhelmed. I'm shocked. I'm surprised. I feel like I have missed an announcement, because she says it to me with such earnestness, with such commitment, with such belief. I think that, you know, in the middle of the summit, I've somehow, like, I've gone to the bathroom and I've missed an announcement that she's actually been released. She had not been released, but what I realized was that Jody, the Big Water Theater Company on both sides of the prison door, and this coalition of activists and organizers, dreamers, that they not only were they propelled by a belief, but they were committed to making a radical change happen. And I mean radical in the sense of transforming, upending the ways of being in the world. And by putting out this declarative statement, Ava is coming home, she named and she claimed that future for Ava. And I don't tell this in the book, but by the time the book came out, that is what happened. Ava is home. Ava has come home. And I went to a Zoom parole meeting for her, and she did come home. She is home. The vision, I guess, of that chapter beyond incarceration, it's though not just about like freeing an individual person, though. It's the hope, the root of the book, and that I learned from the women at all these sites, is that they really want us to heal, to transform, to upend, to disrupt our normative ways of thinking about right and justice and safety and healing and accountability, so that people can actually be accountable to each other in ways that are holistic and healing, and that bring people home in the sense of like returning them to loving, supportive, at least to supportive communities where they know that they are valued and that they belong. And that is the work that the theater companies are striving to do. And they do it excellently and beautifully, masterfully, on both sides of the prison door.
Well, I have enjoyed our conversation today. Can you tell us, what is the next project you'll be working on?
Oh, thank you, Dr. Taylor. I have enjoyed our conversation tremendously. The next thing I'm working on, like I said, I'm a theater artist. There's a couple of plays that I've been thinking about for a long time. One of them is called Afterlife. It was very much inspired by the story of Cynthia Scott that I told, the woman in Detroit who was killed by police in Independence Day, 1963. Afterlife is a story about the 1967 Detroit Rebellion, what some people call a riot, but from the perspective of women and girls who not only lived through it, but lit it up. So that's one thing that I'm working on right now. It's called Afterlife.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that.
Thank you.
Today we've been talking with the author, Lisa Briggs, the author of The Healing Stage, Black Women, Incarceration, and the Art of Transformation. And people can purchase this book anywhere. Thank you.
Thank you.